Few expressions generate as much instant buzz in today's world as the word rights. The modern concept of rights finds its foundation in what historians call somewhat presumptuously the modern world. During the Age of the Enlightenment, the Age of the Enlightenment was the period that followed the Reformation. It was not accidentally the case, by the way, that the Age of Enlightenment followed the Reformation. The Protestant reformers asserted the concepts of liberty of thought and religious expression as ideals. They were not realized fully in the Reformation period, but as ideals that found amplification during the Age of Enlightenment. Quite possibly, the supreme example of that amplification came in the opening lines of the American Declaration of Independence in 1776. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, and that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, and that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. It was, of course, not the case, practically, that all men in that period were considered to be equal under the law. For the principal author of the Declaration of Independence, Thomas Jefferson, owned many slaves and continued to do so until his death half a century later. Nevertheless, out of those words emerged the American preoccupation with rights. And from America, those ideas spread back across the Atlantic Ocean to the nations of Europe, where they had a somewhat uneven development. Along the way, however, most people forgot the connection of those ideals to the Protestant reformers. And succeeding generations of secular politicians labored to make that separation permanent. They argued for rights across a large range of social contexts, leading to the National Holocaust, that is, abortion on demand. And now, within just the last decade, it's well for us to remember that recently, to the public embrace of same-gender marriage, a concept that is an open defiance of that which God has said in His Word. Seeking to cloak this embrace in the language of the movement for equality among Black Americans, the advocates of same-gender marriage and the sodomite agenda in general have asserted such things as civil rights. And as soon as that phrase enters the discussion, reasoned debate evaporates. For who can be against civil rights? But those who drafted and voted for the adoption of the Declaration of Independence did so in the context of existing common law that put liberty into the structure of society that was governed by the law of God. There was sodomy during the age of the founders of this country. But it was, as appropriate, kept in secret, because such activity was illegal and rightly seen as destructive to the whole fabric of a decent and upright society. The reality is that the idea of rights for citizens has its roots not in the Age of Enlightenment, but in the democracy of ancient Greece and the power of imperial Rome. And here you see we're getting to our text. For to be a Roman meant far more than that you lived in the imperial capital. It meant that you were a legal resident of the empire and that as such you had inviolable protections against governmental mistreatment. To be a Roman meant that you did not simply have to sit there and take whatever the authorities dished out. It is significant that the first occasion in which Paul and Silas collided with the imperial power was also the first time when they asserted their rights as citizens of the empire. It would not be the last time. What Paul and Silas were doing in what appears at first to be just a postscript to the dramatic story of Philippi and the founding of the first church in Europe. What they were doing was to say that people do not surrender their rights when they become followers of Jesus Christ. Here we find that Paul and Silas refused to allow themselves to be convicted in the court of public opinion when the local representatives of the imperial power acted without regard to the status of Paul and Silas as Roman citizens. Even more importantly, and I want you to think of this, Paul and Silas did not want to leave the church in Philippi under the cloud of suspicion in the community that it was composed of those who defied the laws of the empire. Paul and Silas were not criminals, but the local magistrates treated them as such. And on that point, Paul and Silas would not flinch. They would not go away quietly. So at this historic juncture in the second missionary journey, we find Paul, as the leader of the missionary team, insisting on civil rights. Insisting on civil rights. Now, there are some who consider such language as I am employing today to be politically and socially inflammatory. They would argue that the Christian's response should never be dogmatic or insistent, but that to follow the example of Christ, Christians must always be submissive to any expression of civil authority. Well, it is clear in this passage that Paul did not agree with that approach. Now, before anyone concludes that Paul wanted Christians to push the envelope and to become activists, let us remember that this was the same man who wrote to the Romans that the civil power was to be obeyed, especially when it was fulfilling its God-ordained responsibility to be a terror to evildoers and for the praise and commendation of those who do well. And I would that the civil power would come back to recognizing that as its responsibility. I think in our days, that responsibility has been turned on its head. Now the civil power is a terror to those who do well, and it is for the praise and commendation of evildoers. Paul was insisting in this passage that the civil power do what it was commanded of God to do in the case of him and Silas. They stood as not convicted of any crime. And yet they had been punished as though they were guilty. Now, in the empire, the concept of civil rights, and I can tell you the Romans would not have used that phrase. That is a modern phrase, you understand that. But the concept of civil rights did not apply to slaves. If you were a slave in Roman times, you were nothing. Whatever happened to you, there was nothing you could do about it. But it did apply to those who were citizens of Rome. Some achieved that citizenship at great cost. But others, like Paul, were born as Romans. The rights of citizens, Paul was insisting, are precious rights. And they are useful in the work of the Christian ministry. So he refused to surrender them out of any mistaken idea of projecting meekness or humility. He recognized that he and Silas received this treatment because of their activities as Christian ministers. And he determined that those responsible for the mistreatment should be called to account. Now, in this approach, he was following the example of the Lord Jesus Christ himself. In the Gospel of John, chapter 18, when the Lord Jesus appears before the Sanhedrin, at one point, the high priest directs someone standing near Jesus to smite him on the face. And Jesus said in response to that, "If I have spoken evil, bear witness of the evil. But if well, why smitest thou me?" So what Paul was doing was following in that example. So to insist on true civil rights is not to undermine your Christian testimony. It is instead to advance it. Now, there are three aspects of this brief passage that we need to consider today. First, quiet manipulation. Quiet manipulation. It appears, as I said already, that Paul and Silas, whether they initiated the idea or whether the jailer suggested it, whatever the case was, that they agreed to go back to the prison, so that when day came, they would be present, and so that the jailer would not be exposed to punishment for failing his charge. They went back to the prison after the jailer took them to his home and gave them medical treatment and provided them a meal. They went back to the prison. And when the morning came, when the day came, as we read here, the magistrates, the praetors, the leaders of the government in that place, the ones who gave the sentence that they should be beaten and that they should be imprisoned, appeared to be having some second thoughts as to whether they'd done the right thing. Perhaps they thought about examples of other Roman officials who lost their positions and sometimes their lives because they mistreated those under their care. Perhaps they were thinking about the earthquake that struck during the night, the earthquake that wrecked the prison. Now, Romans were superstitious people, as are most pagans. And they read omens in events like earthquakes. They may have thought, oh, the gods are not happy. They've sent the earthquake, and there's something that we have done that isn't right. Perhaps they were unsettled by that. In any event, they thought, as politicians today are so adept at doing, they thought of finding a way to minimize the damage, to keep it quiet, to keep it in the background. So they sent word through the sergeants that the men who had been arrested were to be set free. They were to be let go. Now we read here of the sergeants. Interesting, because these two occurrences of the word are the only ones in the New Testament. The sergeants were, to use the Latin expression, the lictors. A lictor in Roman government was the person who marched ahead of an office holder and carried the symbols of office. And in this case, the symbol for Roman officials was the fasces, F-A-S-C-E-S. The fasces were a series of rods that were bound together with, in the center of the rods, an axe. So all the rods were bound together, symbolizing all the people bound together with the binding around them, and then in the middle the axe, which symbolized the power of the people all together. You may have heard in the history of the 20th century of those who subscribed to a philosophy of government that was called fascist. That comes from that word. So the sergeants, the bearers of the fasces, the lictors, were to give the word to the jailers, to the keepers of the prison, that Paul and Silas could go. That there would be no additional proceedings against them. They could go. But what about the charges that had already been made, on the pretext of which the magistrates ordered Paul and Silas to be beaten and imprisoned? If you go back to verse 19, you read, when her masters saw that the hope of their gains was gone, they caught Paul and Silas and drew them into the marketplace unto the rulers and brought them to the magistrates, saying, these men, being Jews, do exceedingly trouble our city and teach customs which are not lawful for us to receive, neither to observe, being Romans. There was the charge. They were subversives. They were seditionists. They were teaching things that were illegal. What about those charges? Well, they were not to be considered any further. And so, if that situation had prevailed, what would the public assume? Those men must be guilty. Now they've been let go, but they were punished. They must be guilty. Now, the magistrates may have sensed that, you know, they didn't follow the rule book exactly right. They didn't follow established procedures. Maybe they were afraid that someone would say, you allowed yourself to be stampeded by an angry mob into doing things that you should not have done. So they were trying to cut their losses. Politicians are great at this. They cut their losses. And there would be some today who would say to Paul and Silas, look, just do what they say. Just go ahead. Think of the ministry that you're going to have elsewhere. Just go ahead. Don't make an issue of it. Don't become controversial here. Don't insist on your rights. After all, you're Christians. And they would cite the example of Christ in 1 Peter chapter 2. You turn to 1 Peter chapter 2. Verse 21. For even hereunto were ye called, because Christ also suffered for us, leaving us an example that ye should follow his steps. who did no sin, neither was guile found in his mouth, who when he was reviled, reviled not again, when he suffered, he threatened not, but committed himself to him that judgeth righteously. And they would say, there you have the example of Christ, and that is what Paul and Silas should have followed. Now, you can be sure that Paul was well aware of that history of Jesus. He may have been an eyewitness to it. He may have been on the Sanhedrin when Jesus appeared before him. So he was well aware of that history. But he also knew that Christ called his servants to commit themselves in their work to justice. And so Paul and Silas refused to go quietly out of town. And that leads us to the second thing that we find in the passage, outspoken advocation. Now, as I say, many times this part of Acts 16 just gets left by the wayside because the events earlier in the chapter are so dramatic that it's kind of reviewed as an interlude between that and the next dramatic moments. And so I never really had much case myself to consider what happened here until preparing for this message. One of the benefits of doing a series of messages is that you can't just skip over things like this. But I was struck by the way in which Paul made his case in a very forthright fashion. The keeper of the prison came to him and said, okay, you can go now. And he probably thought, well, they'll scamper as quickly as they can. But Paul instead asserted their status and demanded that they be treated as citizens under the law. He said, we are not condemned. We have not been found guilty of any crime. And yet, the magistrates ordered us to be beaten. And a Roman beating was not a minor matter. They were scourged. Stripes were laid upon their backs. They stood uncondemned, and yet they had been scourged. They stood uncondemned, he said, and yet they had been imprisoned in the harshest possible conditions. Thrust into the innermost part of the prison, their feet made fast in the stocks. And notice how Paul emphasizes that this was all done openly. They had beaten us openly. That he meant publicly. They beat us to satisfy the mob. It was all out in the open. Now, was their release from custody to be done in private? Paul refused and said, no way. No way. He sent the sergeants back. Take your symbols of authority back with you and tell the magistrates that they couldn't do it like that. Do they thrust us out privily? Nay. Let them come themselves. Let the magistrates come themselves. Let there be a public acknowledgement that they were wrong to have punished us in this way. That upon which Paul and Silas were insisting here was true civil rights. Those were the rights that were designed to protect the innocent. They were not designed to excuse the guilty or the perverse. You know, today, that is the way it is. Civil rights are used to excuse the guilty and the perverse. But they were designed as protections for the innocent. Paul referred to this very concept a little later on in Acts chapter 25. Acts 25. Paul's appearing before Festus. Verse 9. But Festus, willing to do the Jews a pleasure, answered Paul and said, Wilt thou go up to Jerusalem and there be judged of these things before me? Then said Paul, I stand at Caesar's judgment seat where I ought to be judged. To the Jews have I done no wrong, as thou very well knowest. For if I be an offender or have committed anything worthy of death, I refuse not to die. But if there be none of these things whereof these accuse me, no man may deliver me unto them. I appeal unto Caesar. Asserting again his civil rights as a citizen of the empire. Saying, you cannot deliver me to those people. But notice how he said, If I'm guilty of a crime, then let that guilt be proved, and I refuse not to die, if death is the penalty for that crime. So he's saying, I don't object to being tried, but I do object to being condemned without a trial. That is what Paul was saying in Philippi. Now, in this manner, Paul was following the example of the Lord Jesus Christ and was asserting the distinction between being judged for evil doing and being mistreated because of his Christian testimony. Paul was saying there was no way that as a citizen of the Roman Empire, he was going to allow that mistreatment simply because he had been conducting his ministry as a Christian. He had rights, and he insisted on them. Let them come themselves and fetch us out. And when the news of this insistence reached the magistrates, the whole situation changed. And that brings me to the third thing in the passage, honorable adjudication. You know what happened here? As so often happens, it took the insistence of a Christian to get the civil authority to do what it should have been doing all along. You ever have that experience in the commercial realm? You ever had the experience of helping someone else do his job or her job, for which you don't get any of their pay? Well, here, Paul was helping the magistrates do their job. It was his insistence that the public nature of the punishment be offset by a public acknowledgement of the wrong and a public release. Now, when the magistrates got the report, they knew they were in trouble. We read in verse 38, they feared. That's the word from which we get our word phobia. They were afraid. It was more than an irritation. They were afraid. They were afraid for their lives. They were afraid if this gets up the chain of command, if this gets to the emperor himself, we're in trouble. They heard that there were Romans. So, all their thoughts about hushing it up, sweeping it under the rug, so that their prestige in the community would not be affected, so that no one would get the idea of sending a letter to the emperor. So, they came to the prison. Now, can you imagine the difference in the attitude now? If you go up about to verse 22, the multitude rose up together against them, and the magistrates rent off their clothes and commanded to beat them. And then they said, make these people fast in the prison. Now they come, and they besought them. Oh, please come out. Please come out. They entreated them. Please come out and be at liberty to go on your way, hoping they would leave town and never come back. Be on your way. That was the thing that should have been done the day before. They should have had the courage to stand up before the assembly and to say, these men have done no crime. If you want to file a charge, they will be tried in accordance with standard procedure. They should have done that the day before, but now they have to come and they have to eat humble pie. Oh, please leave now. The day before, beat those men. Now, please, leave. But it's significant, isn't it, that Paul and Silas didn't follow that directly. They didn't want to convey the idea that they were in any way under the control of the magistrates. So they went out of the prison, but they didn't leave town right away. We read in verse 40, they entered into the house of Lydia. Now Lydia, we know about Lydia. We read about her last week, the first convert to Christianity in Europe. Not a European, but the first convert in Europe. And there was a church that quickly formed that met in her home, and that was the place where the members of Paul's party were staying. Other members like Luke and Timothy would have been there during this ordeal. So they went into the house of Lydia, and we read there, they saw the brethren. And I was reflecting upon that. What a marvelous statement this is by the Holy Spirit. They saw the brethren. Just a few days before, the only place they could find anybody to preach to was a mile outside the city gate by the river. There was a place where women gathered to pray. Now there were brethren. Now there were men who had been converted to Christ as well. And they saw the brethren, and we read in verse 40, they comforted them. Now how do you suppose they did that? How did they comfort the brethren? Did they say, it's okay, we're kind of sore, but we'll get over it? No, that was not the comfort with which they left them. They comforted them in pointing their attention to Christ. The Christ that they had preached in Philippi. The Christ who came into the heart of Lydia by the Spirit's sovereign power. They comforted them by setting Christ before them, saying they were going to be leaving Philippi, but Christ, whom they preached to them before, they would leave with them again, setting before them Christ in all of His glorious fullness. And that whatever became of Paul and Silas was not the critical factor. It was that they would leave Philippi, but Christ would not. Christ would stay there with the people, though they would not physically be present. Christ would be there. Christ would guide them. And again they would be brought back to behold the glory of the Redeemer. Again and again they would come back to see, this is the person whom Paul came to preach and who has delivered us from pagan culture. They comforted them, and then they departed. And that leads to the next part of the journey, to which we will come in our next message in this series. But I've spent this time just to emphasize this truth, that all of this developed as a result of the fact that Paul would not allow the civil power to behave in this fashion. He knew he had his rights, and he insisted upon them. It was like when he said, when they were about to scourge him in Jerusalem, he said, is it lawful for you to beat a man who is uncondemned and who is a Roman. And when the one who was to do the scourging heard that, he went and told his superior, be careful what you're doing here. This man is a Roman. And that man came and said, are you a Roman? Yes. How did you get to be a Roman? It took me a lot of money to become a Roman. Paul said, I was freeborn. Then the captain, sensing that he had just escaped the same fate that these magistrates were trying to avoid, ordered those who were going to do the scourging to leave. And of course he wrote a letter later saying, I understood that he was a Roman, so I rescued him from the mob. Which was a total lie. But it showed you, I think, the motivation of these people in authority. They wanted to put themselves in the best light when it came to dealing with the higher-ups. But it was because Paul insisted upon his civil rights that he had the luxury then to go into the house of Lydia and to say to the brethren there, the Christ who saved you is the Christ who will keep you and will be with you, even when we go down the road to the next place. This is the Christ who has said he will be with his people. So all of that to emphasize that as Americans, we have rights and we have every reason to insist that they be observed. Because by doing that, Paul opened a door even wider for the proclamation of the gospel.